here with Uza Dinma Iwala, most recently the author of Our Kind of People. Uza Dinma, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you for having me.
Let's get right down to business. I know that with the novel you wrote, Beasts of No Nation, you started off, to some degree, not just with news articles, but you actually met a soldier for that particular work. And with this, of course, there are a good deal of interviews that you did with people who are, you know, who have HIV, who are living in Nigeria, support activists and so forth. So, you know, my question to you is, why do you need to hear stories in oral form before you work out how you're going to tell the story, whether it be fiction or, in this case, nonfiction?
Well, for me, I'm very interested in the way that people speak, both in the creative fiction that I do and also the creative nonfiction. I mean, I like the rhythm of language. I like the sounds of voices, and I like how rhythm and tone actually really are so much a part of the storytelling itself as the words that you put down on the page. I mean, that I think is both a result of sort of having this oral tradition and listening to stories sort of from the culture that I come from. And then also I think there are a number of other writers that I think in the maybe more Western literary tradition that pay a lot of attention to rhythm and flow. You can think of people like Beckett, who I love listening to when read because of that reason.
Did you transcribe the conversations, and did you actually read them aloud to try to figure out how to... You did.
It was a process. It was first doing the interviews.
Yes.
Then I transcribed all the interviews, almost all of them myself, because I wanted to be in it, you know, to hear the way that people spoke again, to really pick up where there were emotional stressors, essentially, in people's voices. And then, yeah, I would take those interviews, sit down, and try to rejig them a little bit to make them flow better as stories. But I would read them aloud to myself over and over and over again, just trying to get the right inflection points, trying to get the right tone, and trying to make sure that the language and the emotional state really coalesced.
So the finer details of these stories are perhaps there in the intonations of the sentences more than the actual biographical details and so forth?
No, the biographical it's nonfiction, so those details are all also very on point. But there was a lot of attention paid to just what it sounded like and how what it sounded like reflected who was speaking.
Yeah.
You know, so your health official in government is going to sound and speak differently and stress different things and have different emotional stressors than your, say, a woman living in a rural area.
Yeah.
Each intonation, each way of speaking equally important and equally relevant to the larger picture of the epidemic, but definitely very different.
How do you track a child soldier down, or even many of the interesting people in this book? I mean, you know, you can't just hold up a sign and while you're walking around Lagos.
Right, right. Well, so for the first book, for Beasts of No Nation, I mean, I just got fortunate in the sense that the first person I spoke to, China Ketetsi, actually gave a talk at Harvard when I was an undergrad. And she just had a lot to say, and we had a very brief conversation. I didn't really interview her, just listened to her talk and her experiences, read her book, and then just it was a chat that I had that really sort of brought out what it was that I wanted to write about. And then in Nigeria, there are a lot of people who lived through the civil war that we had in the 60s, a long time ago, but they still had many, many stories to tell and were very open with me about that. And then also we had Liberian refugees living in Nigeria at the time. Most have returned home now, I think. But in where my family lives, they were doing a lot of construction, and some of these folks would be working on the construction crews. And so during breaks, I would just take time to chat with them, and that's how I got a lot of those stories. Now, for Our Kind of People, I really kind of did just do what you said. I just started walking around and asking questions. And, you know, one person, I mean, obviously a little bit more structured than that, right? So, you know, you go to a health official, and then they lead you to a treatment center, you speak to someone there, and then they lead you to a support group. Or also walking down the street, I walked into bus depots, just found who I could speak to.
Wow.
And we sat down, you know, you buy a person a beer, you sit down.
What else are they doing? They're waiting for a bus, right?
You're waiting for a bus, yeah.
Yeah.
You're either waiting for the bus you're driving to leave, or you're waiting for the bus you're going to take to leave.
Yeah.
You know, what do you have to do but sit and talk and drink? And so that's what we would do. And then they would be like, well, you should contact this person. I'd get a phone number and then go from there.
So you built up a network based off of these peregrinations, right. And you finally tracked down the appropriate people. You mentioned the Civil War, which I wanted to talk with you about, because the Civil War doesn't really come up in this book so much. And in light of what you have to say about Nigeria's reticence to discuss HIV and AIDS, I was wondering if you can get into the character as to why they're reluctant to talk about it, aside from the AIDS support groups, the efforts to spread safe sex messages among the young and so forth.
I mean, I think for a number of reasons, and for the same reasons that people were reluctant to discuss it here at first. It has been a taboo subject. It's much less so now. But HIV/AIDS, the epidemic, especially the way that it spreads mostly through sex, is something that I think makes people profoundly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And we tend to avoid speaking about it. If you can think about how many conversations, tough conversations that you put off and put off and put off, we tend to avoid speaking about those things we find really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's changing, and in large part because people have decided, the federal government and also activist groups and people living with HIV have decided to make a lot of noise and make sure that we have those uncomfortable conversations and really try to bring this thing out so that we can deal with it. I think in general, Nigeria is a relatively, at least outwardly, conservative country. And we're loud people for a number of different things, but there are certain things that I think it would be safe to say are considered more private. Sex being one of them. It's not a place where you see sex sold on billboards or used to sell products as much as you do here or in other countries in Europe or whatever.
Yeah.
So that definitely has impacted the way that we talk about the epidemic.
In the stigma section, you describe how physical deterioration is, of course, a major part of AIDS, and there is, of course, this moral idea attached to it, that people are being punished there for their sins. What's some of the crossover? I mean, the book goes into a lot of dichotomies where there are intersections and where there are not. But in terms of grasping the idea of people who are physically deteriorating and who are suffering, why does this have to be so sinful among certain, moralists in Nigeria? I was very curious about that.
I think we should also say that also happened here as well.
Yes.
And I think with that, what the issue is it's mainly a question of absolutes, I think. In a situation where you don't have access to treatment and the diagnosis of this, being diagnosed with this disease, is in essence an absolute thing. Like, you will die is what people message. And I think it's complex in some senses because its message is you get this, you will die, but you can still be healthy for some years before you start to deteriorate without treatment. But it seems like a final judgment. And so people then map all kinds of anxieties, religious beliefs, cultural, whatever, onto that. And then you get this idea of this being judgment for something. And that definitely came up a number of times, of how initially people would say, like, if you get HIV, that you're being judged for some kind of practice, whether that practice is some kind of immoral sex, whether in this country, it was homosexuality was considered an immoral thing and HIV was punishment for that. IV drug abuse was considered an immoral thing and it was punishment for that. Now in Nigeria, it's more heterosexual sex, much less in terms of IV drug abuse or anything like that. And, we're very outwardly strongly religious societies where the prohibitions on sex before marriage are at least spoken about, all over the place. And so then it becomes very easy for people to make that leap. You have sex before marriage or you have some kind of immoral, by whoever standard, sex, and punishment comes through this disease. And I mean, I think I found that to be a very interesting connection. I mean, it's ages old. There are other sexually transmitted diseases which have always been considered, judgment in some way for immoral sexual practice. But I think the stories around HIV/AIDS, and then also the way that people generate stories about their relationships and their sexual encounters to moralize them in the face of this epidemic, so that you can say, no, well, I might be having sex before marriage, but my relationship, my sexual practice is somehow not like this. This being sinful sex.
Yes.
You get a different, people construct all kinds of things. And I find that to be really interesting and something that we should look at and spend more time with.
So what I'm getting at is that Nigeria is essentially applying the same sort of moral codex to HIV and AIDS that America is, but that they're really just only a few years behind where we are. Is that safe to say? What distinguishes Nigeria from the states along a similar sort of trajectory?
I mean, I think one of the things the book is trying to say is that, you know, while the nature of the epidemic and in the HIV epidemic differs depending on the society it appears in, I think there are many similarities in that. I think what people did originally was suggest that there is something very different about the African AIDS epidemic than in other countries. And there is a difference, but the difference isn't necessarily some cultural whatever or some moral failing on the part of Africans. And I hate using the term Africans, but also I'll go with specifically in Nigeria.
Yeah.
The issue, I think, in a lot of senses, is resources. In the United States, the difference was people recognized the problem and then also had the resources to apply to dealing with the problem very quickly. In Nigeria, the problem was recognized at a certain point in time, but the resources weren't necessarily as forthcoming, and that creates a huge difference. I think it's just very apparent.
Yeah. So, speaking of which, I wanted to actually get into some things you observe about Western coverage of AIDS in Africa, the idea of dropping like flies, which you heard in the 2006 speech, the idea also of the New York Times even using a sort of hysterical headline that was in the sort of Joseph Conrad disease-ridden African racist stereotype. This is as recent as 2006, as you point out. You know, have things improved since then? Where are we at? I mean, are we looking at a very small window of because this has actually really occurred in the last 30 to 40 years? Where's the progress here, and are you seeing some of those regrettable racist stereotypes still incorporated now, or has Western media become reformed?
I think the thing to recognize first is that stereotypes die hard.
Yeah.
The language that's used is hundreds of years old, and if that's been the shorthand for a long time, it's very hard to speak differently immediately. I mean, you can see how hard it has been in the United States to change the way that some of the terms that people use to refer to minorities, to black people, to Hispanics. It's been there. People pick it up, and it's hard to get rid of it. It's also easier for a set of people that you really don't know. I mean, Africa being a continent in the imagination, very far away from almost everyone's existence for whatever reason, though it's geographically very close to a lot of things.
Yeah.
Then you start using shorthand for the other, and that creeps into whatever situations that now present themselves, whether it's describing even positive things, you know, whether, you know, things that you always see, dance, rhythm, whatever. You can go through a whole number of those positive stereotypes. And then, of course, with the negative things, those map very easily in people's consciousnesses. So an epidemic pops up that's spread through sex, and language from before has already pegged Africans as being somewhat more sexual or somewhat more promiscuous or just unable to control our bodies.
Yeah.
And it just maps very easily in people's minds. And that, unfortunately, I think, has really played a role even, you know, up through the 90s in the way that people approached dealing with the epidemic. Now, things have changed. Language has got better. A lot of it has to do, I think, with pushback from people in different African countries saying, look, you know, you can't say these things. You can't treat us this way. You can't stereotype us, and you can't use this shorthand anymore. There's a different language that you need to use. And what I'm saying, or what I was trying to do with this book, is just bring more of that language and more of that attitude to the forefront. So that people can see what people are actually saying about themselves, what people are thinking about the lives that they live, and have this new language that people are using, and it's not new, this language that people are using to describe themselves and their life situations, inform the way the larger discussion on the global level takes place. I would say that it has gotten better. I mean, you can't speak about things in the same way, and I think I show that earlier on, there was some language that was just egregious, and now I think if you published, you know, scientific papers that said certain things, people would laugh you out of the auditorium when you were presenting, and I think that's good.
Yeah.
And obviously, there has to be an evolution. You have to start from some point. You know, if you don't know, then you speak, and then people correct you. And I think people shouldn't be afraid, in some senses, to be corrected, and then also to pay attention for others to pay attention to the correction, so that you don't make the same mistakes in terms of language.
So if we've corrected a majority of the stereotypes, and it seems to me that we have, is that what you're saying?
I think No, I don't know if I would go that far. I would say I think it's harder to just get away with saying them.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that means that people don't slide into them without knowing. And that's maybe the more dangerous situation, is where you're conscious of the big things, but not conscious about how your language, however subtle it is, then affects the reaction and response.
Yeah. So what would you say is the greatest misperception of, say, Western eyes upon Nigeria right now?
Just on the country in general?
Yeah, I mean, or in terms of in relation to AIDS and HIV?
I mean, I think just in general now, there's... I think it's... So let me start baseline. I think it's gotten a lot better.
Yeah.
The idea sometimes in the popular... within the global health community, I think a lot of those... what I was talking about has been corrected, and that there's been a different approach in terms of really going in and trying to listen to what countries have to say about their own priorities and how they want to structure programs to deal with the epidemic in the country's midst. I think on the national consciousness, you see a lot of the misperceptions in a lot of the campaigns that were done, you know, in the early part of the century, meaning, you know, 2000 and up, where this equating Africanness with HIV/AIDS, you know, you have a number of different poster campaigns where it just that connection seems to be made, and then you get this idea that the whole continent is somehow some disease-ridden thing, and that is very troubling to people on the continent who are like, that's not my reality.
Yeah. You know,
that's not really what I see. That's not really what I experience. And also very troubling to people who are living with HIV/AIDS, who are like, look, you know, my life is not necessarily completely governed by this disease. There are other factors that I'm still a person. I'm not a disease with a person. I'm a person, and I have this illness. And I think it's that real lack of nuance and understanding that this epidemic is part of a larger life and not defining life that is troubling. It's changing now, definitely. The question is whether or not certain voices will be allowed to speak to further push that change.
What voices have not been allowed to speak, just out of curiosity?
I think, you know, some of the folks that I were talking to, I mean, you get select few who are allowed on the international stage, right? A lot of the times those voices are mediated. And I mean, obviously, I act as a mediator in my book.
Yeah.
So, but what I tried to do as much as possible was step back when people were telling their stories and when I was trying to relate the stories and let those stories speak about the complexity of their own existences. So that it's not just the three sort of things that you see or stories that I felt like I encountered, which were these woe is me narratives where everything is terrible, I got HIV/AIDS, my life collapsed, or two, this giving thanks narrative where, oh, thank you to these outsiders for treating me and making me whole. And three, which is this kind of, oh, sorry, my I lost it, but I mean let's go with those two.
Sure.
Two narratives, those main ones. Or sorry, three is the other, exotic, out there person narrative. You know, I think what I wanted to get at and what I wanted to have come through in the book was what people were telling me, which is this is part of a existence that can be normalized, and that we should speak of me as a person, a normal person who has to deal with problems like everyone else in the world has to deal with problems. And the more that we speak of people that way, the more respectful one will be on the outset, and two, I think the more room you have for understanding how to approach the epidemic, I think, and treatment of people who have HIV. So,
well, you know, there is one of your subjects who calls you a journalist, and you say, oh, well, it's better than being called a personal crusader or an interested party. You identified the idea, creative nonfiction, that this volume might be, and that might be a taxonomy, I suppose. You know, would you say that you were being journalistic in some sense, or what was this? Do you think that the idea of, I suppose, being a journalist gets in the way of these stories, or...
I mean, I think there are many probably personal hang-ups and questions that come into that, and I think I was trying to address that with that section of the book. I think in my mind I had maybe had it this impression of the journalist as outsider who comes in with a certain set of preconceived notions with themes in their stories that they're going to bring back to the place that they are reporting for.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. I wanted to consider myself more someone who just wanted to find out, to know. Now, you know, it's labels. You can, I mean, I think I was doing what a journalist does. You go out, you ask questions to try and create a story. And it, in some senses, it's semantics. But I think that in my head, I had this idea of what a journalist is, especially the idea of the journalist, the foreign journalist in Africa, you know, the foreign journalist in Nigeria, that I just wanted to not be a part of.
Sure.
Now,
is empathy perhaps that this is, you know, you're in the objective mode, you can't necessarily relate to your subject sometimes?
Well, I mean, I think also the issue is I really wanted to blow apart this idea of objectivity in journalism.
Yes.
That, especially because I think with when countries in Africa are reported on, there's already a subjective tack, and that's the stereotypes that we just spoke about, these age-old things that inform even at what stories people look for. And I wanted to just say, like, look, let's address that right off the bat, that as a person with a particular background, there's just so much subjectivity in the way that I'm going to approach this. The fact that I have some medical training, the fact that I am from this place, the fact that I grew up, was born and grew up in a different country, all these things impact my desire to write the book, how I'm going to write the book, and how I'm going to speak to the people that I speak to. And I think a lot of times in other books about HIV in Sub-Saharan Africa, or other books about Sub-Saharan African countries in general, that idea doesn't get put enough, it's not addressed enough.
There was an Observer review I read of the book, and this guy made the suggestion that because you were concentrating most of your attentions upon Nigeria, that this didn't necessarily account for the other regions of Africa. And he brought up the AIDS denialism in South Africa and so forth. I was wondering if you could possibly address this criticism. I mean, you've been very careful to distinguish, I think, between Nigeria and Africa in this conversation. But, you know, what is common to Nigeria and how does it differ throughout various regions of Africa? And does this contribute to this problem of what we were talking earlier in terms of these stereotypes and so forth?
I mean, I read that review. In some ways, I wish I hadn't. But it's a question in some senses of you can't please everybody.
Yeah.
I was very clear when I set out to write the book. It would be nice to write this overarching narrative of HIV in Africa. I didn't want to do that because that's been done, and I think those books largely in my mind fell short. I said, let me take a specific place. And I'm very clear in the book that this is a specific place. This is Nigeria's epidemic as Uzoyiwala has seen it, and not Africa's epidemic, conflating the conditions and systems in different countries with each other, and then using points made in one country to argue about systems in another. I don't think that works, you know, and I didn't want to do that. And also, I think the individual stories really work well only when considered within their context and not within this monolithic, however wrong that is, African context. You can't please everybody. I think, you know, some of the points brought up about AIDS denialism in South Africa, I mean, they're interesting, right? I think that's specific to the South African context in its own way, and why Mbeki would get up and say that. There's a lot of history behind sort of apartheid attitudes towards blacks, disease, otherness, within that specific cultural context that makes sense, that when you analyze those comments, right, that you need to have that history and that context to make sense of those comments, and also to criticize those comments and to call them wrong the way that they need to be called wrong. That doesn't necessarily apply in Nigeria. You know, has Nigeria had its own set of people who deny that this disease exists? Yes. Have they ever been really prominent? Back at the initial point where everyone was denying that HIV/AIDS existed, yes. After 2000, not really. I think everybody was pretty much like, okay, this thing is here. We have to deal with it, you know?
Yeah.
I think that you have to look at the specifics of the epidemic as in each region or country as it is. But then at the same time, I mean, I think within Nigeria, you also have to be aware that, like, it is very much a regional thing as well. There's some places that are harder hit within the country where you have one place with a 2% prevalence rate, another place with a 12% prevalence rate. It's not uniform. And, you know, I think it's very hard then to write about a uniform epidemic in that sense. And I think that's what I'm kind of trying to draw attention to. Now, is my book perfect? No, it's not. I mean, I think there are a lot of things where I could have expanded upon. And you're limited in some senses by the medium that you choose to use. You know, writing about HIV/AIDS isn't, like, you could write for ages, yeah, for centuries.
It's like Vietnam, you know?
Right. You know, like, there, how many books have been produced?
Books, yeah.
How many people are still writing about the bubonic plague?
Yeah.
You know, like, you can write and write and write and write. And at some point in time as a writer, you have to say, look, this is what I can cover. This is the scope of my book. And I have to look at that.
Yeah. Got it. I wanted to bring up what you bring up, which is Philip Alkabi's essay, The Ordinariness of AIDS. I actually had the pleasure of talking with him on this program, too. He brought up the idea of AIDS being extraordinary because of how it has polarized, like, the global population into this mode of fear and hysteria, and how this driving emotion has caused these biological and social effects to conjoin and intersect. You document the AIDS support groups in Nigeria, but I'm wondering, how do you get Nigeria to acknowledge HIV as an identity, even while you're not recognizing it in the entirety of the country or the entirety of the continent? Is Nigeria any closer today in crossing the boundaries between HIV-positive people and HIV-negative people?
Yeah, so first, that Philip Alkabi's essay, I think, is a brilliant essay, and it just was very inspiring to be able to read, and I definitely quote him in the book. Now, in terms of the identity issue, it's a tough one to navigate. I mean, and I think the support groups, what's interesting is I think people who are in support groups and who are activists also find it a very difficult identity to navigate, because on one sense, you're saying,
yeah,
I have this thing sets me apart. It makes me different from you. And in another sense, you're saying, I'm not different from you. It's hard. I think it's a very, you know, that's why I keep arguing and keep harping on the point of nuance, that
yeah,
it's not a cut and dry thing. And I think that's what Alkabi's is getting at, is that you have to do work to be,
yeah,
able to navigate the identity. And that's maybe what we haven't done internally in Nigeria, and also externally. Like, you have to do quite a bit of work to hold those two things in your head and walk the space between them. I think the more that people do that, the better off we'll be just in general in terms of dealing with issues of identity. Because, you know, everyone is a mix of different things. And in our everyday lives, we hold all these different ideas of who we are, that some of which might be in opposition to each other. And sometimes it's a very helpful thing in terms of how we deal and interact with the world and the issues that we face. And sometimes it can be very problematic, both on an individual and societal level. But you have to want to have the discussion. And I think that's what the book is trying to suggest.
Well, there's also this idea of the new normal that you bring up, that, well, we're drawn to the idea of AIDS as a sort of tragedy or a significant change, that support is in fact going to, you know, cause a dramatic uplift, or there's going to be a dramatic downlift, or so forth. This is our perception. But, you know, as you point out, as numerous other people have pointed out, HIV positive people live perfectly normal lives, and normal isn't always sexy. So why do you think we're stuck in this mode? And if we're trying to attract support for AIDS from outside areas and so forth, don't we have to sell them to some degree on this notion that their money or their support is transformative? I mean, do you have any ideas on how this idea of showing people that HIV and AIDS is normal might also be compatible and change things in how they support other nations and other communities and so forth?
I think you see it, and the best thing to talk about is any tragedy or disaster that is used to raise money. I think you often see this initial response, right?
Yeah.
You look at Katrina, everybody's down there, everybody's
sure,
trying to get in there, because there's a pull, that this idea that you can be in some sense is transformative. You can pull someone from the water. You can build a house immediately and get somebody in there. And that works well. You might raise a little bit in the beginning, but if you focus on, people get fatigued with looking at constant, you can only be bombarded with images of absolute just not goodness for so long. Lost my words there. But then people often complain that as that becomes normalized, there's a drop off in support.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying, because people have now pushed that to the side in their head somehow, they've compartmentalized it as this thing that happened that's not, you know, it's just not, you don't pay attention to it anymore. And I'm saying, you have a very different reaction, right, when you're dealing with somebody that you know, you acknowledge as a person, a friend of yours, for example, that's going through something, where you see them every day, you understand how they were as your friend before, and you also see the slow process of transformation as they are now and after, you know. And I think that if you saw that person on the street, you might stop and give a dollar. However, if you know them and you really understand them as a complex being who has been incorporated into your life and is part and parcel of your own social sphere, your reaction and your support is of a longer and more sustained sort, right? You come to the person's house, you bring them food, you sit and you just talk with them, you listen, that sort of thing. And I'm saying, I think that can be extrapolated, and you can look at that on a global level. It's like, you look at Africa and it's just tragedy. All right, fine, you toss some money this way and then you turn away. But versus, let's say, okay, look, we're all part of this community. This is one part of the community in one area, you know, that things are not going well. Yeah. Let's have a sustained response. You might not raise as much off the bat, but you, I think, certainly will do better in the long run, because you'll keep coming back. You'll keep coming back, and you'll keep tackling the problem, and you'll also be able to adapt in the ways that you tackle the problem as the situation changes. I think if you have a one-stop shop, let's deal with tragedy in this fashion, you're shooting yourself in the foot a little bit, I think.
Yeah. So what's the best thing that someone like me or someone like you can do for HIV in Nigeria right now?
I think one of the things is, again, is just understanding, is moving towards a more nuanced understanding of what this disease means in the society and where it fits into the way that people speak about themselves and the disease itself. So that the more complex your understanding of the problem, I think the better your response will actually be. You know, is when people first said, oh, this is an issue of just people being promiscuous, you know, not such a complex understanding based off of these shorthand and stereotypes that we talked about earlier, the response was like, oh, well, we just need to get these people to stop having sex. And was that necessarily effective? I don't think so. Versus as people began to take a look at what was really going on, you step back, you assess, you take a deep breath, you found, okay, well, let's move more towards treatment, because treating people can provide all kinds of benefits in terms of reducing the rate at which the epidemic spreads, prolonging life for people who have the epidemic, increasing productivity. You have a more complex understanding automatically. Now that we know that treatment, what treatment can do, and if we provide treatment for people in a massive quantity, then you now change again. And you see, you have a different understanding of what needs to be done and how you need to do it. So it's not just get drugs out there, a one-time thing. It's how do we create systems that can provide a sustained response, essentially, that you can continue providing drugs to people who need drugs, because it's a lifelong illness, you know. And with each, with more understanding, with more complexity, with more interaction with HIV/AIDS as a complex phenomenon as opposed to a simple tragedy, you gain understanding and you change and sustain your response.
Got it. Well, that sounds like a lot to take in, but I think it will be good for our listeners. Ms. Aldinma, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
And thank you for having me.
Girl, I know that you wanna get something, something. You really don't wanna get nothing, nothing. All you do is get me confused. I know that you wanna get bumping, and you know that I wanna get bumping. It's all about you.